CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
You're a small to mid-sized business with 300 to 3,000 employees. You face the same network security challenges as big businesses do, but can't support a big IT investment, leaving your doors open to advanced cyber threats. Barracuda Next Generation Firewalls provide all the core features of enterprise firewalls and UTMs, but without hidden costs and deployment hurdles, making owning a big business firewall no big deal for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Next Gen Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/firewalls.
Today on Face the Nation, 15 days till they start voting in Iowa and 23 until they start voting in New Hampshire. And it's getting feisty on the campaign trail. Donald Trump and Ted Cruz have stopped being friendly.
Oh, he finally went off the wagon a little bit and went a little crazy. And it's very, I mean, he's being a great hypocrite.
Donald has a lot of nervous energy. And for whatever reason, Donald doesn't react well when he's going down in the polls.
And on the Democratic side, the surprising surge of Bernie Sanders continues, causing Hillary Clinton to scramble. We caught up with Bernie Sanders in Vermont.
And we think we have a good chance to pull off what will amount to, I think you will agree, one of the great political upsets in modern history.
Not if Hillary Clinton can help it. We'll hear from Clinton this morning as she prepares to confront Sanders in tonight's Democratic debate in Charleston. We'll check in with Republican candidates Marco Rubio and John Kasich, both battling it out to stay alive after the voting begins. It's all coming up on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. I'm John Dickerson. Breaking news this morning, three Americans, including Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian, have departed Tehran, part of a prisoner exchange with Iran announced on the day sanctions were lifted on that country as a part of the Iranian nuclear deal. And this video shows three of the Iranians just released in Houston. This is a swap that's already sparked controversy on the campaign trail. And we start with former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who is in Charleston this morning. Good morning, Secretary Clinton. After this prisoner exchange, Senator Marco Rubio said, quote, if you take an American hostage, Barack Obama will cut a deal with you, whether it's Bo Bergdahl, what he did with the Castro brothers, and now what he's done with Iran. Your reaction to that?
Well, I think it's just typical political rhetoric, and it overlooks some very basic, important issues. Number one, we always try to get Americans back who are unjustly held. I certainly did when I was Secretary of State, and when I was a senator, I advocated for the Bush administration to do the same for people who had been unlawfully held in foreign countries. Secondly, the important news here is that the Iranian agreement to put a lid on the nuclear weapons program of Iran is being implemented. The Iranians have so far fulfilled their side of the bargain by destroying centrifuges, by shipping out 98% or so of their enriched uranium out of their country, even, you know, making one of their plutonium reactors under construction no longer able to be ever used because they poured cement into it. So the real issue here is, if you're committed to making the world safer and to show strong American leadership, you have to engage in patient, persistent diplomacy with people who are not your friends. They are on the other side of a lot of the issues and values that you hold very dear, and that is certainly true for the United States.
Former FBI agent Robert Levinson is still in Iran. Do you believe that the Iranians know where he is? And if so, why wasn't he a part of this deal?
Well, I regret deeply that Bob Levinson was not on his way home either, and I hope and expect that the Iranians will continue to be pressed very, very hard to give up any information they have and, if possible, to return Bob Levinson to his home and family.
Switching to the topic of gun control, you've said Bernie Sanders should vote or support the idea of lifting the immunity block on gun manufacturers. He now says he'll support the legislation you've pushed him to. So hasn't he done what you wanted him to do?
Well, I am pleased that Senator Sanders has flip-flopped on legal immunity for gun makers and sellers. Now I hope he will also join members of Congress to change what's called the Charleston loophole. that enabled the killer in Charleston to get the gun that he used to murder nine people at Bible study here in Mother Emanuel Church. That's something else Senator Sanders has supported that we need to change. So now I'm calling on him to also flip-flop in the right direction and sign on to legislation to change the Charleston loophole.
You had once in 1993, when you were first lady, supported in testimony in front of the Senate Finance Committee a 25% tax on guns. You're not supporting that now or promoting that now. How have you evolved over the years in terms of your support for the Second Amendment?
Oh, I do support the Second Amendment. That has always been understood. I just believe that, like any amendment to our Constitution, there are reasonable steps that can be taken. You know, we have reasonable restrictions on certain kind of speech or certain forms of assembly. And for goodness sakes, we ought to be smart enough and do so and consistent with the Constitution to have more gun safety measures to try to save some of the 33,000 lives that we lose to gun violence every single year. This is something that I have spoken out about, that I have advocated for. Right now, I think there is a consensus in the country on comprehensive background checks, closing the gun show loophole, closing the online and Charleston loopholes, reversing the immunity given to the gun industry, certainly prohibiting would-be terrorists on the no-fly zone from buying guns. That's the kind of common sense approach that we should be working to achieve.
I'd like to ask you about these stories out of Flint, Michigan. Lead levels in the water have created an emergency there. Senator Sanders has called for Rick Snyder, the governor, to resign. What's your feeling?
Well, John, this is an issue I've been involved in now for a couple of weeks. I am horrified by what has happened in Flint. I started calling for immediate action, calling for federal intervention. I sent two of my top campaign aides to meet with the mayor of Flint. As you may know, I appeared on a show this past week and demanded that Governor Snyder ask for the help that Michigan needs to deal with the horrible consequences that, you know, children and their families are facing in Flint. And I saw that Governor Snyder turned around within 2 hours and finally asked for the help that he should have asked for some weeks ago. I don't want to get caught up in the political back and forth here. I want to help the people of Flint, and I particularly want a comprehensive health analysis of what's happened to these children. You know, lead is a poison. It destroys your brain. It interferes with your learning and your behavior. Whatever it takes for Michigan and the federal government to come together through FEMA, through Health and Human Services, the EPA, whatever it takes, we now have to fix the problem and help these kids, and especially their health and education development, probably for years to come.
On the topic of health care, back at the national level, your daughter, Chelsea Clinton, said that Senator Sanders' universal health care plan will dismantle Obamacare, dismantle Children's Health Insurance Program, and a series of other things it would dismantle. Isn't she and your campaign not taking into account that those things would be replaced by an actual plan that Senator Sanders has put forward?
Well, I think it's very confusing because he hasn't put forward a plan. And the only way we know what it is he's advocating for comes from looking at the nine bills that he's introduced in the House and Senate and Congress. And in those bills, every kind of health care is rolled all up together and handed over to the states, which bear a financial responsibility to match what the federal government provides in order to administer health care. So it's not a traditional kind of single-payer system, as I understand it. It is a state-based system, kind of similar to Medicaid, if you will. And I do think there are very legitimate questions that can be raised. And because we don't have an up-to-date plan from Senator Sanders, all of us are trying to figure out what it would mean for everybody to be put into that new system.
Well, Senator, Secretary Clinton, I know that will be debated this evening when you're on the stage with Senator Sanders. We thank you for being with us.
Great to talk to you again, John.
Face the Nation after this short break.
While most video surveillance solutions capture and store hours of nothing, CUDA Eye by Barracuda Networks only captures video when something happens. Once captured on camera, the video evidence is immediately encrypted and sent to the cloud for safe storage and easy retrieval from any web browser or mobile device. With CUDA Eye, there's no network configuration or software to install. Just plug one or more cameras into your network to better protect your business. Don't get caught with nothing. Do something about it. Check out CUDAEye.com. That's CUDAEYE.com.
And now we turn to Bernie Sanders, who we caught up with in his hometown of Burlington, Vermont, Friday.
Hillary Clinton, she said, because she understands Wall Street, she can, and she told me this last week, regulate Wall Street. And she said it's kind of like Nixon going to China.
It's not Nixon going to China. That is exactly the opposite. Nixon was a vehement anti-communist who went to China. Hillary Clinton is somebody who has received significant sums of money from Wall Street.
But she said she went to Wall Street and told them to cut it out in 2007.
Right, cut it out. Well, you know what? Cutting it out is not good enough. Give you an example. Just give you an example. Literally today, a Goldman Sachs, it was announced, is paying a $5 billion fine. $5 billion for their duplicitous work on subprime mortgages. $5 billion bucks. And what the American people are seeing is huge bailout for Wall Street while the middle class continues to disappear.
Switch to taxes for a moment. Your tax plan, you haven't put out your rates for personal income. Republicans say they could be as high as 90%.
Well, that's a lie. I know. Well, Donald Trump has said that over and over again. I don't want to shock you on this one, John. Just because Donald Trump says it may not be exactly the truth. That happens to be a total lie. We will get it out, but let me talk about taxes. Because we have probably put out more information on taxes than any other candidate already. And what we are saying is that we're going to end this outrageous provision that allows big money interests like Wall Street firms to park their profits in the Cayman Islands and other tax havens, not in a given year. In a given year, pay a nickel in taxes. We're going to end that. Wall Street may not like it, but we are going to impose a tax on Wall Street speculation so that we can make public colleges and universities tuition-free and substantially lower interest rates on student loans. So we have already put out a number of tax proposals, I believe more than any other candidate, which will help us transform American society, demand that the wealthy and large corporations stop paying their fair share of taxes.
So we'll see rates from you soon.
You will see that, absolutely. But it is not, this is nonsense.
You've raised questions about Hillary Clinton's plan for paid family and medical leave.
Yeah.
What's your concern?
Well, here's the concern. She doesn't have a plan. That's the concern.
She'd say the same thing to you about taxes. We're still waiting to get your rates.
Wait, but there's a difference. We have presented, I think, more specific tax proposals than any other candidate. But in terms of family and medical leave, here's what you got. The United States is the only major country on earth that does not guarantee paid family and medical leave. Now, there is a bill in the Senate, and what it says is we will guarantee 3 months paid family and medical leave. Is it free? Of course it's not free. The cost of it will be about $1.61 a week for the average American worker. I think that's a pretty good investment. Hillary Clinton chooses not to support that legislation.
But she has her own plan, and her
really?
Plan is to tax people who have benefited from...
Oh, no kidding. I have not quite seen that plan.
Well, it's out there. And
no,
in fact,
it's not
it
out
says,
there.
It says that she'll take the money from taxing those people who benefited from the economic inequalities, which sounds like a Bernie Sanders plan.
Well, it's not a Bernie Sanders plan. It doesn't go anywhere far enough. It's not a plan. It's a vague idea. If you want something to be long-lasting and where the people have ownership of it, they know nothing is for free. You're going to have to pay something for it. When you do something like a vague idea, oh, we're going to tax the wealthy on this one, it could disappear tomorrow.
Healthcare, when you hear Chelsea Clinton say, as she did this week, that you want to dismantle Obamacare, dismantle the Children's Health Insurance Program, dismantle Medicare, dismantle private insurance.
I know, leave millions and millions of people out there with no health insurance at all. Yeah, I've only been spending my entire life making sure that as many people as possible get health insurance. That is just an unfortunate statement that Chelsea Clinton made. The Affordable Care Act, which I helped write, which I voted for, supported, has done some good things, no question. But we have got to go beyond that. We've got to join the rest of the industrialized world. Healthcare for all is a right, and we can save the middle class families thousands of dollars a year in their healthcare costs.
Donald Trump says unless he wins, all of his efforts will be wasted. Do you feel the same way, or do you feel like already you've had an interim achievement?
We started this campaign, as you well know, at like 3% in the polls. We are now ahead in New Hampshire. I think we're closing the gap in Iowa. I think we have a good chance to win both those states. I think we have a good chance to win this election. And I think the reason that we are going to win is that people are sick and tired of status quo politics and economics. They want a president who has the guts to stand up to the billionaire class and start representing working families.
When you were at the State of the Union, did you think that might be maybe up there?
Actually, the thought did cross my mind, honestly. It did. And, you know, it's a very humbling experience, feeling. But, you know, we're running hard to win. We think we have a good chance in Iowa and New Hampshire. And we think we have a good chance to pull off what will amount to, I think you will agree, one of the great political upsets in modern history.
Did you just think about it and that's it, or did you start making plans?
Yeah, well, I was jotting down my inaugural speech. And I, oh, no, you know, no, not quite. It's a long way to go before we talk about inaugural speech, before we toss State of the Union speeches. Yeah.
You have suggested you are the more electable Democrat in a general election. What is it about you, Bernie Sanders, that makes you more electable?
I think we have an appeal to young people, to working class Republicans, to Democrats, obviously, to independents. I think what we are seeing in the Sanders campaign is a great deal of energy and excitement. It will translate into a large voter turnout. Large voter turnout not only means winning the presidency, it means recapturing the Senate, doing well in the House, winning governor's seats all over the country.
There's a perception that you have a weakness on foreign affairs. Is that something you need to improve as a skill to be president, or are people just misinformed about
it? Well, you know, I don't think I have a weakness on foreign affairs. Is it true that Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State for 4 years? Yes, of course. Does that give her a great deal of experience in foreign affairs? Obviously, it does. But it's not just experience. It is judgment. I voted against, not only did I vote against the war in Iraq, I helped lead the opposition to the war. Hillary Clinton voted for that war, one of the worst foreign policy blunders in the modern history of the United States. So you know what? Judgment counts when you're talking about foreign affairs.
You said Donald Trump is a pathological liar.
Yeah.
Why specifically?
Well, I'll give you one example. I mean, there are, when he goes around telling people that I want to raise their taxes by 90%, that's a lie. Never said that. It's not true. Number two, more importantly, he is trying to divide this nation, okay? And he tells us that the Mexicans who are coming into this country are drug dealers, they're rapists, they're criminals. I mean, that's just a lie. But even worse, he goes around saying, I, Donald Trump, I saw on television thousands of Muslims celebrating on 9/11 when the Twin Towers went down. It's a lie. There is no evidence. There was never anything on television. It never happened. He has not apologized. He keeps saying it. That is a pathological lie.
All right. Senator Sanders, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, John.
Our full conversation with Bernie Sanders is on our website at facethenation.com. We'll be back in a minute to hear from the Republicans. Turning now to the Republicans, we spoke with Florida Senator Marco Rubio in Sioux Center, Iowa, earlier. We began by asking him about the prisoner swap.
Well, first, let me say they're not prisoners. These people that were being held were hostages. None of them had violated any real laws. And in fact, some of them weren't even charged. One of them was a reporter. The other one was a pastor. And they'd done nothing. And let me just say, Bob Levinson is still missing. The Iranians know where he is, or we believe they do. And they're not being cooperative about that. We should not forget Mr. Levinson and his situation. But going back to the point, these people were hostages. The people America's releasing, they were convicted in a court of law after due process of helping violate sanctions. The president has pardoned them in exchange for a release of hostages, which had done nothing wrong. And it proves, once again, that now nations and enemies of America around the world know that there's a price for Americans. If you take an American hostage, Barack Obama will cut a deal for with you, whether it's Bergdahl, what he did with the Castro brothers, and now what he's done with Iran.
What about
we're happy they're coming home, but they never should have been held prisoner in the first place.
What about the quick resolution of the 10 sailors earlier last week? John Kerry, the Secretary of State, said that is another instance in which diplomacy helped solve that faster than it would have in the past.
Well, again, imagine if those sailors had wandered into Israeli waters or Egyptian waters. We never would have heard about it because there wouldn't have been an instant thing going on there, an incident. They would have had their motor repaired and sent back on their way. Instead of what happened, Iran grabbed them, put them on their knees, put their hands behind their head, forced them to apologize on video, made the female sailor wear a burqa, you know, filmed them in captivity in that room. all in an effort to show how powerful they are and how weak we are, and a huge propaganda score. This is not the act. They're not our allies. They're not our friends. And ultimately, they released them, but only after achieving what they wanted from it, and that is to prove that if they wanted to, they can grab American sailors and subject them to this treatment.
Let me ask you about propaganda. President Obama, in his State of the Union, said that with ISIS, when Republicans say it's too grave a threat, it plays right into their hands. You've said it's a clash of civilization. So are you playing into their hands, as the president has charged?
Well, I think playing into their hands would be to ignore the reality of what ISIS has become. ISIS is not just some group of radicals on the back of pickup trucks. This is a group that's grown in both influence and sophistication. They have a very sophisticated propaganda program that are recruiting foreign fighters. They have a sophisticated understanding of foreign immigration practices. You've seen how they've been able to insert people into Europe using the refugee crisis. There's a group that controls significant territory in Iraq and in Syria. This is a serious threat. Can we defeat them? Absolutely. But only if we have a real war against them, which is to find them and destroy them. And if you capture any of them alive, send them to Guantanamo and find out everything they know.
You said this threat has changed the nature of the immigration debate. You said during the debate this week it is dramatically different than it was 24 months ago. But during the immigration debate in the Senate that you were very much a part of, there were two amendments, one that dealt with visa overstays because of possible terrorists using that visa overstays, and another one about securing the border first before any kind of a deal. You voted against both of those. Weren't people worried about security at the time, and not just because of ISIS, in terms of terrorist threat?
Well, let me correct you about those amendments, because they had already been dealt with in other amendments. For example, John Cornyn had an amendment on the border, which I supported, actually. I also sponsored or was a co-sponsor of the largest border surge in American history, 20,000 new border agents, completing 700 miles of fencing. As part of that, there was a biometric entry-exit tracking system that is required to prevent visa overstays, so we could identify people that had overstayed, know where they were, and be able to remove them from the country. All of that was either dealt with or about to be dealt with in the amendments that I supported.
So the threat was not a new
threat. But as far
as
this... Well, it's a different threat. We clearly have in the past always had terrorist groups that have had an interest, but we've never had a group like ISIS that has an in-depth understanding of foreign immigration practices. For example, we know that one of the killers in San Bernardino entered the U.S. on a fiancé visa, something that most Americans didn't even know existed, and that process broke down. We didn't have the refugee crisis that we're now facing. We have always had terrorist groups, but even Al-Qaeda and some of the other groups that are out there are regionally based. They strike at America, as they have in the past on different occasions, but their focus was primarily on the Middle East. This is a group that has global ambitions of conquering and you know, flying the black flag of ISIS over the White House. So the ISIS situation is dramatically different from any other terrorist threat we've ever faced. It is the most active, sophisticated, well-funded terrorist group we have ever confronted, and they need to be defeated. Either they win or we win, and when I'm president, we're going to win this battle.
Let me ask you about becoming president, a political question. There are a lot of people who are nervous about Ted Cruz and are nervous about Donald Trump and would like to coalesce around one candidate. But there are a lot of other candidates that you're competing with. Why not just make the argument and say, don't vote for anybody else because we'll split the vote, back me as an alternative to Ted Cruz and to Donald Trump?
Well, actually, I've been saying now for a while, I believe I'm the only one in the primary field that can unite the Republican Party, which is critical, but also attract new voters who haven't voted for us in the past. But I believe I am best positioned to take our principles of conservatism and convince people that haven't voted for us in a quarter century that we're a better choice than the other party. And I know this, Hillary Clinton does not want to run against me. Their attacks are constant from their campaign. I cannot wait to run against her. If I'm our nominee, we will defeat her, and we're going to turn this country around.
There's been a lot of people buying firearms recently, and you bought one on Christmas Eve. Why?
Well, first of all, I'm not home very often, and so those were one of the few days that I was there. Second, I have a right to protect my family, and that's why I was previously a firearm holder as well. This was an additional one. And again, I think many Americans around the country feel the same way. I'm a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. I have a right to protect my family if someone were to come after us. In fact, if ISIS were to visit us or our communities at any moment, the last line of defense between ISIS and my family is the ability that I have to protect my family from them or from a criminal or anyone else that seeks to do us harm. Millions of Americans feel that way.
All right, Senator Marco Rubio, thanks for being with us. And we'll be right back.
You don't have to be a retail giant or government agency to be the victim of a costly data breach. If you run a website and collect customer data, your small to mid-sized business is just as likely to be targeted by hackers. The Barracuda Web Application Firewall provides cost-effective instant security against automated and targeted attacks, making this WAF a must-have for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Web App Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/WAF.
President Obama appeared in the cabinet room this morning and spoke about the Iranian nuclear deal implementation and the prisoner exchange.
The United States has never been afraid to pursue diplomacy with our adversaries. And as president, I decided that a strong, confident America could advance our national security by engaging directly with the Iranian government.
Now we want to go to Republican presidential candidate and governor John Kasich, who joins us now from Columbus, Ohio. Governor, you've talked about the importance of diplomacy. So how do you evaluate this recent release of prisoners and in addition, the 10 sailors who were released earlier this week?
Well, John, you know, it's sort of funny. I woke up this morning and it's interesting that I would be thinking about the Iran deal as I was getting ready to come over here and the Iran nuclear deal. And I'm sort of sick to my stomach about it because what's going to happen is Iran's going to get a ton of money. And this money they can use, you know, to spread a lot of trouble in the Middle East. In fact, there have been reports from some other Arab countries that they're actually more worried about the economic gains of Iran than they are what they think is the potential development of a weapon. I mean, I've heard this from various people. Look, I just think it was a terrible deal, what they did there. And in terms of the release, I'm glad these people are out. But, you know, they were there on trumped-up charges. I mean, you know that reporter who was held there for a very long time, who every journalist in America said, you know, was falsely taken. You know, they trump up charges, and it's a bad situation. We're glad they're out, but, excuse me, we don't want to have the Iranians just grabbing people and then trying to get their own people out. But we ought to focus now on this Iran deal. And, John, my sense is if I were president today, I would be meeting with every one of our allies around the world and saying we're going to monitor this deal, and if they violate one cross T or one dotted I, we need to slap the sanctions back on. What I'm concerned about is if they violate the deal, you know, money's going to talk, and some of these countries are going to continue to just move forward and excuse Iran, and that's just simply not a good development, and it's a bad deal, period, end of story.
And so very briefly, before we move on, you don't think that this diplomacy, the release here, is a beneficial result of that deal and all the negotiations that were put in. That's the argument that Secretary Kerry is making.
Well, look, I mean, the fact that they're communicating, you know, and these folks got released, I guess you could make an argument like that. But let's go back to the reporter who was arrested under trumped-up charges. I mean, remember, I was down at that White House correspondence dinner where every single speaker called on the president and Iran to just get that gentleman out of there, and they have. But, I mean, the guy had – it was no business being held. So – where's the great victory here, John? Right. The great victory is for the families. I mean, I'm thrilled for the families that their relatives have been released. But, I mean, to say this was some great thing, I just think is overstating it by a long shot.
Let's talk about politics. You're moving up in New Hampshire. Are you going to win?
Well, look, I got three endorsements here within the last 24 hours of three significant newspapers in New Hampshire. I'm running second in three out of four polls, and you know, I want to be a story. I just got to have John Dickerson talking about me the day after the primary. And if that happens, then people are going to finally begin to hear me. You know, right now, you know, I'm low in the national polls. People don't know me. But, you know, we're doing okay, and we're doing really, really well in New Hampshire. And we got, I mean, there's no question, the greatest ground game in that state of any campaign, and maybe one of the greatest ground games they've seen in modern political times. Our people are everywhere. It's impressive.
The National Review, there's an article saying you should maybe be Donald Trump's vice presidential pick. What's that a sign of in terms of you're in the conversation, but they think you should be his vice president?
Obviously, people who have too much time on their hands didn't have anything else to write about.
You're doing well in New Hampshire. Do you have the structure to be able to continue on? Long slog after New Hampshire.
Well, we have people on the ground in South Carolina. We got people on the ground in Nevada. Trent Lott in Mississippi is my chairman. Greg Harper, the congressman. We're going to, you know, we have the best organization in Mississippi. I've got the governor in Alabama. And we're doing well in other southern states. We're on the ballot now in over 30 states. And, John, then at some point it's going to go to Illinois, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. Who do you think is going to win there? So, yeah, I mean, we will move forward. And, look, people didn't think I was going to get in. They didn't think I'd make the debates. They didn't think I'd make the money. And look at what's happened. So we're like the little engine that can. So keep an eye on us. And if we come out of New Hampshire as a story, I'm just going to tell you, John, I believe I'll be the nominee.
I want to ask you about something. Governor Nikki Haley of South Carolina, we were just talking about that state, in her response to the State of the Union, she said, "Today we live in a time of threats like few others in recent memory. During anxious times, it can be tempting to follow the siren call of the angriest voices. We must resist that temptation." What was your reaction to that?
Loved it. Loved her comments. You know, the other thing is, John, I don't know if you notice the debates. You know, I travel around and people say, you know, you're the adult. You're the one that makes sense. You're the one with the experience. How do we get you more attention? How do we get you more time? Look, in this campaign, I'm very proud of it. And I'm proud of it because we're raising the bar. You know, what happens today in American politics is that if you don't yell or say something really extreme, the media ignores you. So I said one little funny thing about Bernie Sanders. I said, well, you know, Bernie's the nominee. We'll win all 50 states. That got more attention than everything else I said in the debate. But you know what? At the end, the people themselves, they do good analysis. That's why we're rising in New Hampshire.
All right.
And that's why we're going to do so well.
Okay. Senator Kasich, the little engine, we'll see you at the depot.
Governor, stop downgrading me.
Sorry, Governor. I apologize. I got senators coming and going over here. Thanks, Governor. We've got a lot more coming up.
I might start talking about Bob Schieffer if you keep it up, Dickerson.
All right, Governor. Stay with
us. We'll see ya.
Joining us now for some analysis on the developments involving Iran and the United States are Robin Wright, a fellow at the Wilson Center here in Washington. She's also a contributor for The New Yorker. And CBS News foreign affairs correspondent Margaret Brennan is also with us. Robin, I want to start with you. Two big deals happened yesterday. Coordinated, not coordinated, the release of the prisoners and the lifting of the sanctions.
Well, 2.5 years ago, the United States initiated this diplomacy with Iran on its controversial nuclear program. And at every session, the Americans brought up the cases of the Americans imprisoned in Iran. And after a year of kind of getting no place, they realized they better establish a secret second channel with a different set of players. It was so secret that even other members of the nuclear team didn't know about it. And it was supposed to be a parallel track, but to move at their own pace. In the end, the momentum of one influenced the momentum of the other, and they came to fruition at the same time.
Margaret, the sanctions have been lifted. Now this swap has happened. Where is the United States now with respect to this deal, but also in its relationship with Iran?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, who other than John Kerry can pick up the phone and speak to the Iranians right now? There still are no diplomatic relations with Iran. So this is really, in so many ways, a test case. Let's see how this deal plays out, if inspections are unfettered, if over the next 10 years all the Iranians do what they have promised to do. But it's really a question of, do you look at this two ways? One, the Iranians have made a business of hostage taking. You could argue that has paid off to their benefit. This secret channel with Iran started in the first place over three hikers who were taken prisoner many years ago.
And that's the argument essentially that Marco Rubio makes.
Right. And John Kasich hinted at that as well. Or you could look at it and say, this is a triumph of the moderates in Iran, really persuading the supreme leader that this is a track they should pursue. The thing, if you go with that argument, it's kind of hard to conclude that thought at this point, because this was not an ideological deal. This was an economic choice by Iran. So it's kind of too hard to tell yet if this is really a new age. It's certainly a new stage that we're at in U.S.-Iranian relations.
Robin, Secretary Kerry, when this deal was announced, said we're going to continue to be as hard on Iran on those other issues as we ever have been. Well, this question of testing missiles, intercontinental ballistic missiles from Iran, what's the test there to see if the United States really is being as hard on them as they said they would be after this deal was agreed to?
Well, Iran conducted missile tests in October and November, which were in violation of a UN resolution. And so as a result, the United States has today imposed new sanctions for those missile tests. And the message is, look, we do want to move into a different era. We do want to clean the deck on our past disputes and disarm Iran from the most deadly weapon in the world. So they have made progress on that front, but the United States' message is we're going to continue to be tough, and we will impose new sanctions when warranted. And that's exactly what they've done.
Margaret, what's the reaction been in the region? When this deal was signed, there was a lot of Republicans saying that Israel's going to make moves on its own. Other nations in the region, Sunni nations, are going to react. Where are things? What do we know about that reaction?
Right. Well, up until this point, this has all been an argument about a piece of paper. Now the deal actually has to, you know, play out. And so this is going to be the test case over whether those arguments about, you know, Iran sort of getting this big payday, which, by the way, Iran says only about $30 billion of the $100 billion is going to be liquid for them. A lot of it's tied up. So it's not necessarily the payday that some would argue they are getting. However, money's fungible. Who knows how that money is going to be invested in other ways for Iran. And so it's going to be a sort of a wait and see. But there is some truth to this argument that whether it's Saudi Arabia, whether it's Israel, whether it's others, they are less worried about the nuclear program than they are about the empowerment of Iran to continue to interfere and meddle in the region. And that is still a problem for the United States. So it was interesting to have the White House say earlier this week that now what happens with Syria is another test for Iran. Can they be helpful on the diplomacy to end the war, the civil war in Syria, which they are direct players in on the ground? And so that's the next sort of test. But it's still unclear. When President Obama leaves office, what is the relationship the United States is going to have with Iran?
Yeah, and they're wondering who's going to pick up that relationship,
exactly.
Which is the point of our election. Robin, before we go, we have about 30 seconds or so. A former research assistant of yours is one of those released.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he worked for me in 2009. Gregarious young man who spent many years in Afghanistan as well as in Iraqi Kurdistan. He'd actually been to Iran on vacation, thought it was interesting. He had learned a bit of Farsi in Afghanistan and wanted to go back to take an intensive language class. He was just finishing up his four-month course when he was picked up in early December.
That's amazing. Well, thank you, Robin, for being here. Great piece in The New Yorker. Margaret, thank you also for helping us understand this. We'll be right back with our political panel. And we're back with our panel. Tavis Smiley is the host of The Tavis Smiley Show on PBS and has a new book out, The Covenant with Black America, 10 years later. Michael Gerson is a columnist for The Washington Post. We're also joined by Molly Ball of The Atlantic and Washington Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal, Jerry Seib. Jerry, let me start with you. Set the stage for us tonight. The Democrats are having a debate in Charleston. Set it up for us.
Well, first of all, I think we're in a new phase of this race. And you really have two races going on. There's a national race where Hillary Clinton is still in very good shape. We have a new poll out today that shows her leading nationally among Democrats by 25 points. But there are state races in Iowa and New Hampshire that in the short term matter a lot more than the national picture. And there, Bernie Sanders has basically evened things up. So they have to fight. And I don't think Hillary Clinton wanted to get into fights with Bernie Sanders. She wants that energized base that he represents to be with her in a few months when she presumably gets the nomination. But now she has no choice. So they'll be arguing about Wall Street, who's tougher on Wall Street. And they'll be arguing about gun control, who's tougher on gun controls. These are litmus test issues for that base that Bernie Sanders talks to all the time.
Molly, is it close because of something Bernie Sanders has done or something Hillary Clinton has not done?
Yes. I think it's both of those things. I think you have, number one, an attempt to sort of coronate a candidate who fundamentally doesn't inspire the Democratic base, especially where the Democratic base is today. The Democratic base is in a much different mood than it was 8 years ago when they were just hoping to get rid of George W. Bush. This is a real, there's a real sort of rising liberal tide in America. There is a real sense that they want to push a progressive agenda. And so Bernie Sanders has become the sort of unlikely messenger for that, and in a way that he didn't expect, in a way that I didn't expect. And so it has to do with Hillary's deficiencies. It has to do with what Bernie is offering and the consistent message that he represents, having talked about these issues for decades.
Tabs, do you think there's something Hillary Clinton should have done? She's at the stage now where she's getting a lot of second-guessing articles appearing in the Washington Post, New York Times. Is there something she should have done, seen this coming and taken on Sanders earlier or something?
I wonder how she must feel. In 2008, she gets blindsided by a black guy from the left. And in 2016, she's blinded by an old white guy from the left. So she didn't see it coming either time, number one. But I think in this particular race, that's what Molly basically said a moment ago, she's out of step in some regards with the electorate, and Bernie Sanders has tapped into something, particularly around the issue of poverty and income inequality and economic immobility that people are responding to. What she should have done, perhaps, is to be a bit more progressive on those issues. I got in trouble a year or so ago when I suggested and asking, after being asked a question about whether or not she ought to be challenged when we thought this was going to be a coronation as opposed to an election. I said I wanted to be challenged from the left. Number one, because it'll make her a better candidate in the general, number one. Number two, it might make her a little less hawkish in her policy positions. But number three, it's going to make her a bit more progressive on these issues that she ought to be addressing. So I'm glad that Bernie at least has made it a race. And if you're a black voter, and I think black voters are going to help decide this Democratic nomination. Obviously, you love the fact that your vote for once matters and people are fighting over you.
Yeah, she's more progressive, but also more hawkish. Michael
yes.
Gerson, Bernie Sanders says he is the electable candidate in the general election. Republicans I talked to and the candidates say this, that if they ran against Bernie Sanders, John Kasich said it, we'd win all 50 states. Yeah. What's your assessment?
Well, I agree with that because would be very much a Jeremy Corbyn moment. You know, over in Britain, the Labour Party has chosen a leftist because they wanted to vote against Blairism. They wanted to reject the middle ground positioning. And if Democrats were to do, pick Sanders, they would be much in that same position. But I think the interesting thing about Hillary Clinton, though, is how poorly she's doing among young voters, among young women voters, which is just extraordinary. She's losing in large numbers millennial voters to Sanders. So she's got some real problems.
Molly, Secretary Clinton would like the debate right now to be about guns. Is Bernie Sanders, who has shifted his position just in the last few days on this question of immunity, is he in trouble on that issue? Does she have an opportunity there?
I think she's put him in a very tough spot on this issue. And it's clearly, a political ploy, but it's an effective one because this is the one issue where Bernie Sanders is significantly out of step with that liberal base that he otherwise is so in tune with. And he faced an impossible choice. He had to either flip-flop, change his position that he's had for a long time, and thereby get rid of his image for consistency and for being ideological rather than political, or he had to stick with a position that's very unpopular on an issue that Democrats care about more and more. We've seen Democrats really get energized around this issue of gun control that they really sort of put in the deep freeze for the past decade because of the thought that it was hurting them in rural America. And so, given the choice between, as Hillary said earlier on the show, flip-flopping to the right position or sticking with an unpopular position, he finally gave in. And that's been very interesting. And I think you're going to see her nail him on that by saying, look, this man who you see as so pure is just another politician on this issue.
And Bernie Sanders will just talk about Wall Street.
Exactly. And as we had a story in the journal yesterday in which we said the difference between them is that they both want to go after Wall Street, but Bernie Sanders wants to do it with a mallet and she wants to do it with a scalpel. He's saying basically break up the big banks, send people to jail if necessary. And she's saying, let's regulate smarter. Let's do Dodd-Frank plus. Let's do all the smart things. And so she's got the 10-point plan, and he's got the 1-point plan. And this happens to be a year where the 1-point plan seems to be more effective than it would have been.
Well,
otherwise.
And you remember in the last Democratic debate, he really made her squirm on this, and she did not have a good answer. This is when she came back with 9/11 to the question about Wall Street.
But if the question is who's more anti-Wall Street, Hillary Clinton's not going to win that. She didn't choose to go back and represent Arkansas. She represented New York State in the U.S. Senate. Those are her people. Yeah. She is associated with them, and she's going to have to move to other issues in order to win the debate.
Taz, I want to ask you a question about your book and this lead in the water in Flint, Michigan. There is a sentence here in Chapter 9, Assuring Environmental Justice for All, that reads, if a community happens to be poor, black, or of color, it receives less protection than does an affluent white community. Flint has a majority African-American community. Do you think that's what's happening there?
I think it's a case in point. I think that when you are politically, economically, or socially disenfranchised and you're forced to live in certain pockets in this country, this is precisely what happens. And then you get treated like an afterthought. When you raise the issue that something is wrong with the water, people don't take you seriously. And so on the environment, on health, on education, on so many other issues, African Americans and poor people continue to lag behind. This book points out that in the last 10 years since the original text came out, black people have lost ground in every major economic indicator category. Every major category, black voters, the president's most loyal constituency, have lost ground. And the environment's just one of those issues. So environmental racism is real. And we're going to see these cases come up more and more and more. We see it in Porter Ranch, not exactly a poor community out in California where I live. But in poor communities, this is an old story. It's making national news right now. The timing is right, wrong, but right in terms of a presidential election. But these incidents happen all the time. They just don't get this kind of exposure.
And maybe they will in the debate tonight.
I hope so.
Let's switch over to the Republicans. Michael Gerson, the Trump and Cruz friendship has gone through a dissolution. Where do you think that fight is, and where is the Republican race right now?
Well, I think, unfortunately, from my perspective, Donald Trump had his best debate. There's very little question about that. And particularly on this question of New York values, he very much bested Ted Cruz, who was left in the split screen clapping for Trump, which was a kind of assertion of dominance. So that it's engaged now. A lot of Republicans, however, think of this as the Iran-Iraq war. They want them both to lose, right? And someone to come in a third lane that can challenge these two very developed constituencies right now.
But that third lane is quite crowded, isn't it?
Quite crowded, and it's getting mean in that third lane. That's the big problem that the establishment people around this town are worried about, which is to say, well, maybe Marco Rubio will emerge, or maybe Chris Christie will emerge, or maybe John Kasich will emerge. But they're all busy sort of slicing each other up right now. And meanwhile, Ted Cruz and Donald Trump kind of proceed down the path in their own lanes.
I'm sorry.
No,
I was going to say, somebody had better emerge, because as we all have to admit this today, and we know this in the politics, that Republicans can continue to win gubernatorial races, senatorial races, congressional races, but their presidency will continue to vex them if they can't find a way to expand their base. And Cruz and Donald Trump do not expand the base. So in some regards, it's much ado about nothing unless somebody that emerges that can expand the base.
Now, I was just going to make one final point, which is that we have to remember that this picture, like all these pictures, can change radically once voters start having a say. The 2 weeks before New Hampshire and Iowa and the 2 weeks after can look quite different, and we never are quite sure how.
Molly, to Tamas's point about the expansion of the party, we saw something kind of extraordinary this week. There is a race going on the one hand, between Republican candidates, and then Nikki Haley gave a response to the State of the Union in which she said very warm things about undocumented workers, saying that they shouldn't be treated harshly. And then she also talked about anger taking over too much. It seemed like the Republican Party was sending a message to its own party.
Mm-hmm. It was really profound to see the president in the end of his State of the Union saying that we shouldn't listen to these voices calling us to tribalism and so on. And then the Republican response, the official Republican response, not just some random Republican politician, really sounding the same note. There is a sense in which the professional political class collectively is panicked by the forces that they see Trump having unleashed and that they see Cruz also sort of riding along with. Now, Cruz is extremely well positioned here, and I am not convinced that Trump actually won that exchange with Cruz in the debate because the goodwill that Ted Cruz has with the sort of talk radio faction that's been giving Donald Trump a free pass is going to really help him now that those two are in conflict.
Last 20 seconds to you, Michael.
Yeah, we concentrate on the horse race element here, but there are big issues at stake. Is the Republican Party going to be the party of exclusion? They're really deciding whether this is normal, whether this is acceptable. And I think that's where we need to focus.
Great. Thanks, Michael. Thanks to all of you. That's it for us today. Thanks for watching. We leave you today with someone that both Republicans and Democrats can support, Bebe, the Bebe panda, who made his public debut here in Washington last week. Today's guests were Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Marco Rubio, and John Kasich. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producer is Jill Jackson. This broadcast was directed by Brian Nailsnick. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation, John Dickerson, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.